everybody, and welcome to Not About the Weather. This is episode 29, and if you have never, ever, ever tuned in to an episode about Not About the Weather, this is a podcast where sometimes we actually do discuss the weather. However, as one iTunes reviewer likes to refer to us, we are the greatest podcast about everything and nothing, which is how most conversations about the weather begin. So, we exist. That's a thing that is happening. And we usually get together a panel of 3 to 4 hosts from various podcasts around the podcast verse and discuss things that are bothering us in pop culture, things that we're loving in pop culture, and every little nuance in between. So for this week's episode, I am Brittany. I'm joined by Mitch and Natalie. And if you want to talk to us about anything and everything, you can get in contact with us at NATW Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Gmail, anywhere in the world. You know, just find us. Our website is notaboutheweatherpodcast.com. And you can also follow that as a Tumblr account and send us an ask. And NATWpodcast.com also exists as a hub for this podcast and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which
R.I.P.
probably know. Yes, and R.I.P. So this week, like
what
I said,
our origin story, it's there.
Yes, which I've never seen an episode of Teen Wolf. Well, except that 5 minutes that one time while I was waiting to watch Natalie and Karen do something else. But let's get into it. So Mitch, Natalie, how are you doing? How was your Sunday/Monday in Australia?
Good. Yeah, it's cold. Weather-wise, it's cold. The chill is settling into the East Coast, but it's not as cold as it's going to be. So
he's talking about the weather.
I am. Yeah, I had to because you said we sometimes do. I'm like, all right, now's the time to do it.
to be very honest, my like gut response was like it was really hot this weekend. It was, but I am okay. I am better now than I was the last few months of complete and utter adamant. So that's an improvement. I'm starting to claw the broken pieces of my life back together. No, nothing that tragic happened. I was just very ill and have had a strange couple of weeks of really strange
and wonderful
upheavals, but they've kind of spurred a lot of productivity, so that's cool too. Just had a meeting this morning with my volunteering organization that I mentioned on the last podcast, Random Acts, and yeah, I'm okay. I actually feel pretty good, which is shocking for 2018.
Well, it's because it's almost over.
That's true. So yeah, maybe
that to look forward to.
Maybe like thank God. Yeah,
I don't really know that there have been many years in modern times that people have been like. Like it's a meme almost, or like a known thing that like you just say 2018 and you know it's the year.
2016 was really bad.
A year,
and that was like every possible horrific thing could happen, including like all of those insane like big celebrity deaths and all of, you know, the election. But I didn't expect 2018 to be this rough, and it is. So it's long. Someone mentioned on earlier, they're like, you know, we had an Olympics this year and it feels like about a decade ago. And like, yeah, just the news cycle, the speed of the news cycle is just
unrelenting.
It really is.
It's just fucked. And I like, so there's been so many things to happen that it's too much. Like, it's just kind of like, I just want to like stop and like just not engage with anything at all, which probably helped by the fact that I was like so mentally addled from this deficiency. FYI, everyone I've ever met, if you ever feel like a bit like, if you start feeling like you're getting literal, and I mean literal dementia, have your doctor test your blood for a B12 deficiency, because while mental illness is a massively important thing and mental deterioration, sometimes things that seem like mental illness are actually literally a physical deficiency stopping your nerves connecting in your brain. And that's been happening to me all year, and it has really not helped with handling the events of 2018. Just so many things that would be like the biggest story of 6 months, or the biggest like crisis of 6 months, or a year or a decade have just like been like happened and forgotten about and happened and forgotten about this year. And it's just fucked, basically.
Yeah, wasn't there like a 7.0 earthquake in Alaska recently?
What? I didn't even know. What?
I know.
Oh, yeah, that was like on Thursday or Friday.
Yeah. I can't. Everything. It's every. You cannot even start listing them because they are like, they're all things that would be like the event of the year, either in some in a good way, most in a bad way, and they're all just like, thank you, next. Like, it's just gone.
Oh, God.
Like,
Natalie, you have snaps. Just like Ariana Grande, you are her level right now.
I am not her level. I freaking wish. But anyway, carry on. Please take me away from this year and this conversation.
So there's still some time to fill this year with complaints and, you know, some wonders. We've all found things that, you know, are keeping us going, however small they may be. But while we're on this train, we might as well just stay on it, I think, personally, and kick off with our grapes. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's wise.
I'm happy to do that. Yep.
Do you want to go first, Natalie, while you're on a roll?
Yeah, okay, I guess so. Apparently I'm sassy. again, if you've never listened to this show before, the main structure is a segment that we like to call an obsession to share and a grievance to air, which each host brings to the table a particular thing that's pissing them off, frankly, and a particular thing that is, as Brittany said, keeping them going and getting them excited. So we call these our hypes and our gripes. Sometimes we flip a coin, but often we like to do gripes first and end on a high note. So that's what we're going to do today. And I can go first. One of my biggest ones, I mean, always, but at the moment really fucking with me, is people, fans, viewers, internet pundits who have no patience for storytelling, like serialized storytelling. You know, TV, right? We watch TV. There is a large, collection of people that seem to not really understand the art of storytelling. And I mean, yeah, lots of different people are on lots of different levels about the media they consume. But I'm talking about the fact that they're like impatient about something not happening yet or not really appreciating like the slowness of something or thinking that it is a failing of the creation rather than an intentional holding back, you know? Yeah. Like, you know, people that kind of want everything spoon-fed to them, you know, as formulaic. I will use Supernatural as an example because it has been happening a lot this season, but it is definitely not specific to this show. On Supernatural this season, in season 14, there's been a big shift in how the story is being told in that there is not really an overarching omniscient view of like, oh, there's a villain over here and we know everything that the villain's doing, but the heroes don't know and we're waiting for them to come together. It's been pretty slow in a way that I both believe and know from having done like several interviews this year is intentional. It's a story about someone going through a massive trauma and we are staying with their point of view. We are only knowing the things that they know. We are not seeing the big picture. We are seeing things unfold as it unfolds for the actual lead characters. And we basically don't have a lot of clues as the audience that the guys have. I love this. I will admit it's not necessarily normal for the show. We actually do often see a second track of, you know, the big bad or whatever. That is not happening. It is slow. It is regressive. It is confusing. And it is intentional and very sophisticated storytelling in that it is staying close to the mindset of the characters. Like, because like trauma is very regressive and it's like you can get, you know, you can think that something's okay and then have a relapse about how you're handling it or all of that kind of thing. All of that is built into the way that they're telling this story because the massive events of the previous season in which Dean Winchester was like possessed by an archangel, agreed to be possessed by an archangel and kind of met the fate that he avoided for like a decade, this thing that he's meant to have been born for and always never did. People seem to have kind of been expecting that story to be about like the actual events of what the Archangel is doing. And it is, kind of. But it's so very obvious to me that what the story is actually about is about how that event affected him as a person and like what it did to his sense of self and his behavior and like coming to terms with that. And I mean, the show has been talking for a long time, and especially recently, about how they lean into the fact that the length of the show means that people are more invested in the characters than like a snappy plot. And while the plot is super important, the characters come first, and it's okay to spend time with them because we care about them, not because we're like getting caught up in a, you know, fast moving mystery, that we care more about what happens to them and their mental state and stuff like that. Given the degree that this show kind of like has influenced people to write fan fiction and write all sorts of, you know, alternate versions of the story where pretty much, you know, they're just like, you know, domestic dramas or coffee shop AUs and stuff, you'd think that people would get on board with being so close to the character point of view rather than like a snappy, like twirling mustache villain plot. And they would appreciate like leaning into like this slow, deep exploration of like the character's mental health. And some fans are, but I'm seeing a lot of fans who like think that this is like a failure, like that the show's only got 20 episodes this season rather than 23, and they're like wasting time not getting to the plot. And I'm like, no, this is the plot. This is the plot because the guys are the plot. The plot is not the villains and stuff like that. That what, how they feel, that's the plot. And it's really surprised me that people are not understanding this. And we saw it with Marvel a bit as well, and we've seen it with all sorts of things, just the kind of that divisive. We're getting to this point in media. Netflix is a big part of it. Writing episodes of TV that don't have like a five-act structure for broadcast is a big part of it, where you don't have like, you're not writing to like a little climax for every ad break. Storytelling is getting slower in a way that I think is positive. And it's not spoon-feeding information in a way that I think is positive. And apparently this is kind of creating a bit of a chasm of people who are super on board with this and people who are not adapting to it. Have you guys seen anything like that? Brittany, I feel like this might be something that you have some thoughts on.
Yeah, definitely. So I think there are certain shows where I, too, appreciate a slowdown in the storytelling, or especially if you're used to, like, one format. So Supernatural, for example, I mean, I've only watched like what, a season and a half. So but you know, it's very formulaic and it's good. And there's character building underneath it, but it's very much like, oh, this is a guy, like, you know, this is who we're fighting this week. And like, then as you were saying, like there's cuts to like the bigger overarching big bad of the season. And like Buffy did it, Angel did it. That's like how that formula works. But when they decide to take a break from that and like get into deeper storytelling, or they get new writers on a show, or there's just, if this is with any show, like they want to do something bigger and better, and the fans will appreciate it in the
eventually
end. Yeah, it can feel jarring and off-putting, but I respond much better to those types of episodes where yes, there's like, you know, you're still hitting all the familiar notes, but you're spending more time isolated from those familiar notes. So like no one except maybe me and five other people in the continental United States watch Elementary still, but they've been doing a lot of that in the last two seasons where it's like, yes, every, like they were still doing, I think they did 18 episodes this last season, but they're also a 24 episode season. And, you know, you don't really get into those bigger arcs unless you're like heading into a mid-season finale, or you're heading into like a end of the year where the final four episodes are all about that one case or that one thing. And but that's when, you know, they unpack these bigger personal stories to the characters. So with Elementary, they were doing a lot of that this season because they were almost 100% certain, myself included, that they were not getting another canceled season.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, CBS burned off 18 episodes, I think, in 15 weeks, and they were the first renewal for the network. And I was like, everyone was taken aback because if you watch this season, it's about Sherlock and Joan. And that is the heart of the show. It's a character study of what would Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson be in this universe. And they really dove into that because they were ending it and people were invested in these characters. And well, yeah, the five people were invested in these characters. And, you know, just watching them go through like, okay, they did something this season where what if, you know, Sherlock, because he keeps getting beaten all these times because he puts himself in horrible like situations, like has something actually wrong with his brain. What does that exploration of his disconnection with what makes him Sherlock Holmes look like? And then what does that mean for Joan, who's becoming like more of a detective in her own right? Like, it's different and it's frustrating. And yes, some of the paths that they chose were a little weird of how they were addressing it, and like it felt a little shaky, but it's new for them. It's new for the audience and it took a lot of adjusting. But in the end, it set up the last three episodes of this season were like so hard to watch because they were so deeply personal about the characters and where they had been and where they're going, that it was like great. And you're happy that it's coming back. But at the same time, it's like, you don't know what you're getting in the middle. And so, yeah, I definitely have that experience, not just with Elementary, but that was just an most recent example of a show taking that pivot and like doing something great with it. And a lot of shows can do something great with it. It's a matter of paying attention to not losing sight of the characters.
I think a lot of you guys are saying kind of describes my experience with watching Teen Wolf, because I found that there were a lot of like supernatural elements that were not explained. And at first I found it very frustrating that they kind of like would drop off like Jackson, for instance, after we were just learning all that was going on with him. It was like, cool, we have this new mythos to explore, and then he's gone. And then we would have other characters written off or die. And that's where it kind of felt like you can get fatigued to a point where if your main characters aren't sticking around enough, you're like, okay, now Derek's gone. So who else can stick around that I'm even going to then be interested to see what's going on, because we're not explaining our supernatural stuff. We're not explaining our character stuff. We're just kind of moving on and trying our best to cling on to what we can here. But Supernatural doesn't really have that problem because it goes on with those now three main characters, it seems.
Yeah.
I don't watch it either, but it seems like you guys, everybody who watches Supernatural, are enjoying the fact that you do get those characters from your pilot, basically, on until now. It's a lot, you know? It's a small cast, but it works. It works.
Teen Wolf is an interesting one because a lot of the characters leaving was not the show. It was like the actors being like, leaving, and it was a bigger cast of leads. But Teen Wolf was very interesting because it did not do formula. It did not do cases of the week. It was every season was they didn't have a lot of standalone episodes either for character or for cases. They were season arcs of a big mystery, similar to Buffy, but with less intervening monster of the weeks. Teen Wolf did not do monster of the weeks at all. Supernatural, yes, it started as that formula that Brittany mentioned, and there are a lot of episodes that are still a case of the week, like that are still like, you know, we're solving something. But the shift that Brittany mentioned about trying something different, yeah, Supernatural's in its 14th season. It has not been case of the week the whole time. You know, like it is a really, really character-driven show, and it kind of has been since the like first few episodes. Like the creator was originally planning like a, you know, two guys in a car kill monsters, and that it was a case of the week, and that their story was merely a vehicle for like horror, you know, his horror stuff. And then the other producer was like, no, this is not, this story is the character relationship. And it sort of grew into that very quickly, grew into that very solidly. There's always intervening procedural episodes, but every season is more and more arc based. And honestly, the show's arc from season one to season now, it's barely really divided into seasons. Buffy, for example, was very self-contained each season. It was like, okay, so this season we have Glory, and this season we have like the big bads of season six were not really related to Glory. Like there was some knock-on effects from what happened with Glory, but Supernatural's like each one threads into the other very very tightly. Couple of failings, but mostly it's a single thread since the pilot. You can see the steps that have been taken to get from A to B to C to D to L to M to Z, you know, like very, very, very connected, very, very tightly. And it has definitely left them with the, you know, priority of character first. And that's gotten even tighter in the last couple of years. Last season, for example, Scooby Natural, which you saw, Brittany, obviously.
Of course I did, yes.
Was the only real standalone episode. There were case episodes. There were episodes where they stumbled into a case and had to handle something, but they were related to the main arc.
Well,
as opposed to, hey, there's a vampire in, you know, Duluth, you know, like, let's go and check it out. It was tighter than ever before, and this season is even tighter and even slower. I love it, but apparently that adjustment is not that great for some people, and I don't understand it, but it's definitely not just this show. It's the serialized movies. It's people who go into kind of like a Marvel movie and are expecting like are angry that they don't understand like what's happening. And I'm like, yeah, it's just like a really long episode of television that there's like, you know, 20 other episodes that you actually do need to see. Producers and creators are trusting audience investment in serialized storytelling. I feel like that some of the audience aren't showing up and actually earning that trust.
That's fair enough. Yeah, it takes a long time to gain that trust in the show because we've been burnt by so many other shows. What we're going to talk about later for my gripe with The Walking Dead has earned my distrust. It should. Mm. It's horrible. I still watch it, but that's a different case. We will get there. But you need to earn your audience's trust that you're going to follow through on your threads. You can't just expect them to blindly trust that.
I mean, it's not just about threats, but it's just about, to me, it's about the idea that media structure of what was quote-unquote allowed for a film or for a television episode or for a season structure has changed so much. Like, there is really a shift from, like, oh, you have to do it like this because of the general audience expecting this, or like, you know, like I said, the five-act structure for broadcast television, as opposed to like writing something that even if it is going to be on broadcast, they know that that's actually not the structure that it needs to have because it will survive in binge watching and streaming and stuff like that. Of course, stuff made specifically for streaming platforms which don't have that structure at all. And there is an increase in like how creative you're allowed to be, how slow you're allowed to be, how outside the box you're allowed to be with the kind of stories you're telling and the way that you're telling them. And we're in a period of adjustment where people are kind of not prepared for that because they're being programmed to like respond to a certain thing. And it's just a bit disappointing that there's more and more allowances for people to not spoon feed an audience, to actually rely on an audience's investment and rely on an audience's intelligence, and that not all of the audience is like actually like playing ball with that, if you know what I mean. On the flip side, there's like lots of shows that pander and dumb things down, and that's annoying as well. But in this case, I'm kind of feeling bad for the creative side that the audience are not playing ball with their very sophisticated advancements in storytelling.
Yeah, and that's frustrating to watch because, like, you know, especially with people being so active on social media and quick to respond to watching something in real time and immediately taking offense, that with everybody on social media, like, you know, they are talking directly in some cases to the writers and taking out their frustrations instead of waiting for an arc to pay off.
Yeah, I'm just and like, yeah, like,
it's,
yes.
It's hard as a fan, too, to see that happening and being like, no, you're doing a great job. Please keep doing what you're doing.
Just wait don't for give it.
In, yeah, don't give in to the screaming masses. Give in to the people who are quietly waiting and happy with what you're doing.
And trusting the story.
Yes.
Yeah, like, it's that's very true. Like, you know, there's been examples of, like, you know, in one episode that, you know, like, you know, whatever, something happened. You know, why didn't they say this? Why didn't he say this and address this? It's not fair. And he's done all this stuff. And then, like, the very next episode, like, that thing was addressed, which, of course, was not a response to the screaming. It was already planned. It was that the storytellers know that, okay, in that moment wasn't for him. and, you know, but we know, we do know it's going to happen and it has to be happened, so we're going to verbalize it here. For example, there was, like, you know, one thing where, like, Dean was, like, talking about his trauma and people were like, why didn't Sam tell him, like, that it's not his fault and he's all good? And anyone with, like, a couple more brain cells than that was like, because he knows that took a lot for Dean to, like, open up and speak, and so he's just letting him monologue and he's not going to steamroll that with his own thoughts, even though his own thoughts are, like, positive towards Dean. And then the very next episode, like, you know, they had one, like, brother moment in the car having a sad conversation in episode 3. Then the brother moment in the car in episode 4 was literally Sam doing the thing that these people had been screaming about, that was just, like, when Dean's not on guard and kind of not dragging this stuff out of himself, like, you know, Sam gave him the space to speak. And then in the next episode, when Dean was, he, you know, got Dean relaxed, got Dean having a, you know, a kind of a better mental state. And then at that moment, he was like, you know that this isn't your fault. Like, it was done very well and very on purpose. People are just not patient or appreciating. I'm kind of like, what do you want? Like, how do you think this would actually work? It's not just this show. It's many things. And I appreciate the advancements in storytelling and the patience and the trust and the slowness. Ariana, like, I think we're going to do a whole other episode about that, but Ariana's just fallen in love with Schitt's Creek, which is my literal number one favorite show of all time now. And she was, one of the things that she was saying, and I really want to get her to come on and speak about it more, is that the character development in that show is so slow. They're acting like they have 20 seasons to get to this self-actualization in this character. They're trusting that, and, you know, they might not, probably won't get 20 seasons, but they're not writing in a way that's, like, forced faster than that, and they are just, like, actually leaning into that kind of very slow subversive growth. And that's a really brilliant example, and I'm just so glad that people are actually being able to make these stories that are a little less gimmicky and a little less you know, hitting structural beats in a way that used to be the norm. And I really hope that the audience catches up with this, because I feel like plenty do, but there are also, like Brittany says, plenty that are, like, they're screaming about stuff that they think is a failing that they don't seem to understand is, like, completely intentional. Maybe it's just not for them, but I don't know.
Yeah, and also, like you were saying with Schitt's Creek and stuff, it's these tinier shows, or even Supernatural, like, they're doing, Supernatural's not tiny by any means, but, like, there are shows that are doing...
not big for, in terms of, like, it's, like, very C-list, does not have a lot of viewers, but, yeah.
Yeah, but it's, like, these little shows that are doing these great things that are, like, you know, there are the shows that are being, like Big Little Lies, like, that's a big budget studio cast, and they're saying that everything's brilliant, and it is a brilliant show. But what people and studios and fans also have to recognize is that smaller shows are doing great things too. And that's another thing that, like, kind of frustrates me, is like, again, one of five people who watches Elementary, I will constantly say that it's doing great things, and it's not being, you know, it's viewed on the outskirts as a CBS procedural.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is, kind of, but it's also doing this great stuff. And, you know, Schitt's Creek, it's like, oh, well, it's only, you know, it's just there. It's doing, like,
it's a little comedy.
Yeah. Whatever. No, it's not. Yeah. It's doing great character work. And Supernatural, oh, I haven't watched that in 10 years. It's probably still the same monster of the week. No, you haven't watched it in 10 years. It's not that show anymore. Like, it's something better and something deeper. And,
I mean,
these shows are evolving.
This spins into a whole thing that I get angry about every awards season, which is, like, different, you know, genre and procedural and stuff. Yeah. And, like, and what's deemed as, like, great writing, great performance and stuff like that. Like,
if your name is Ryan or Murphy, you're going to win.
There are episodes of Supernatural that those actors, if put into actual fair competition, would have got Emmys for. There are episodes where the writers would have got Emmys. Like, the way that things are relegated, like, because of genre or because of, like, stereotyping and, like, what is quote-unquote, like, good or highbrow television, that's a whole other way of a big story. But, yeah. Hashtag give Jensen Ackles an Emmy. But, he's the best actor I've seen on television ever in any show.
He's good. He's very good.
Well, it's also that those two boys have spent more time working on one character than anyone currently working on television. Like, they have spent every single episode living those characters. They know everything about them. So there are no characters with deeper layers on television because they have literally not only been living them for 15 years, they have been going on tour, speaking one convention a month with thousands of fans, answering questions about the characters, and so of the writers and so of the showrunners. Like, it's just, I'm not saying like it's like the show is like built by fan committee, because it's very much not, but it is miles deep in terms of what these people know about the characters, what these people are writing to in the characters, and how instinctive the actors are. So, yeah, anyway, it's just, yeah, the issue is not Supernatural. The issue is so, so much wider reaching. I'm just noticing it this season a lot with Supernatural, and it's shocking me because it is such an enduring show of 14 seasons, and I'm like, how do you not trust them by now? Like, it's not like it's a new show. It's not like you don't know what they're doing. It's not like you don't love the fact that these characters are massively deep. So what is your problem? Like, where is this coming from? What is this issue when you have every single reason to trust the show? Like, it's just very strange. But anyway, there's so much. It's, I mean, yeah, the world of television especially is just changing so much, and it's all very strange.
So, Mitch, why don't you tell us about a show that's not changing and leaning into its worst qualities?
Yeah, so...
I have never seen this show.
Me either, don't. So I'm excited to hear about it.
Yeah, I'm sure you guys have heard the headlines as it's gone on. So as a general background for what the show has been doing to us for, I don't know, 4 seasons now, they like to fake out major character deaths because they're trying to change it up from the comic adaptation that they're doing. So they're trying to make sure that it's interesting for people who have read the comics. There are not many people who read these comics. And so in doing that, they keep making really stupid decisions. For instance, they had Steven Yeung, who was on Avatar The Last Airbender, and I'm sure many of our, or he was Korra. He was playing the first Avatar and whatnot. He's a great actor, and he did everything from the pilot. He was one of the few actors to even be in from the pilot, and they screwed his character over by sacrificing his true death scene in the comic books, which they did give him eventually, but giving him a fake out death scene. They had him, like, on screen, it looked like he was being ripped apart by zombies, but it was actually a body on top of him. And they somehow tried to pull it off as, yeah, that just looked like he was getting ripped apart by zombies. It was so stupid. So then he hides underneath a dumpster for a couple of days, and then he's good to go. Then he gets hit over the head by Negan and his bat, and then he dies just like he does in the comics. And it's like, you cheated us of that emotional significance by really making us feel like he was dead. Like, showing, like, blood spurting out of him, but it was just a body on top of him. Like, it was so beyond... They just did this again with the show's main character, Rick Grimes. Yeah, it was bad. Basically, all they did this time is they kept hyping up, this is Rick Grimes' last episode. You'll never see him on the show again. They didn't explicitly say he was going to die. But
I did see this to kind of go down, and I am actually very offended on the audience's behalf.
Oh,
on this.
God, it's so bad.
Carry so on. Bad. Yeah, I was actually, this actually did catch my eye, and I was like, that is...
I'm boiled. Yeah, yeah. No, it's like basically what they did, and the short of it is, I'm just gonna spoil it, whatever. Skip through.
You don't even have to say about the plot. I just saw the thing about like the mini series, like the fact that, well, they hyped him as, like, you know,
they hyped it like he was going to be killed off. They didn't. Yeah. They kept him alive so that he can come back to do like 4 mini series,
his,
like,
own,
basically like Sherlock, you know. It's like it's gonna be its own like hour and a half TV episodes. They're calling it movies, and it's going, because there's like a time jump going on right now as well, so like they just jumped right after his fake out death, and they didn't give us any of that fallout, because they're like, now we're going to have you in some fashion, probably from a different subscription or some kind of payment. I'm sure they'll come up with their own streaming service, AMC. And then they'll have you watch then these Walking Dead movies starring Rick Grimes. It's just so stupid, because they have been playing this off like his death for so long. They've been saying, like, even him, the actor, Andrew himself, has been saying in interviews I'm done. I don't want to go back to this show.
Well, that's
and then he comes back and does more. It was such a stupid, why do that to us?
I'm very confused about the order that this happened behind the scenes. Because I don't watch this show, but I know at Comic-Con they were, all grieving. You know, the cast was all, giving tributes to him. And, you know, it was known that Andrew Lincoln was leaving the show. Fun fact, I cannot really see him as any other thing than Love Actually because I've never seen this show. So, my image of Andrew Lincoln is, not normal. But anyway, I saw all these people paying tribute to him, other cast members and stuff like that. It was big news. And I did these movies get developed after he announced he was leaving and they got him back? Because it doesn't really if this was a plan the whole time, I found it very cruel. I found it very as someone who is very deeply affected by stories, a character it would genuinely, there are characters I would, really genuinely grieve for.
Yeah.
And really be affected by. And I feel that that's not, if that's the case for him, that what they did was, very cruel to people's emotions. In more than a way that it's just a TV show. Maybe they don't really think that people feel like that about them, but I don't really understand, who gains from what they were doing. It just doesn't really make any sense to me.
Because the show started to fail in its viewership, so, which not really, because it's still high in the millions. It's, I don't know, 3 million as opposed to its 18 million it used to get. So they're seeing
really?
That.
It's dropped that much.
It has, and it should, because it's been this really crappy storyline and storytelling in general, because ever since they brought in Negan, it's gotten even worse. Ever since they killed off Glenn, Stephen Young's character, it's gotten worse. And they just keep doing these kind of fake outs, these really stupid things. Talk about a show you can't trust, because it had to fill out its plots, like you were saying with Supernatural, as it does. The Walking Dead does not. There have been characters that have literally just walked off screen, said they're coming back later, and they're never brought up again. And they will not be brought up again. So you have no investment in anything. You have no investment in the deaths. You have no investment in the storylines being fulfilled. And even if you think you see a character die on screen, it's acting like a hokey horror movie. You can't even trust it if they're beheaded at this point, I swear. They'll still come back and they'll write it in a really bad way. And it's not going to be exciting or fun for anybody, except for their viewership will increase for that given episode.
I'm just looking at the ratings. Because the first I heard of The Walking Dead, their ratings were about 15 million. And I'm that's... Yeah, the season 7 premiere or something was 17 million and it's now down to 5, 5 million. And that's I mean, it's still a lot of viewers, but that's a huge drop. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, my main knowledge of Walking Dead is via Negan, because Jeffrey Dean Morgan is from Supernatural. And so they have a lot of jokes and stuff about that.
Right.
But it's interesting because you would not handle Supernatural in that case, because all of the deaths are, they're not fake outs, but they're real. Everyone's deaths on Supernatural are real, but because it is a Supernatural universe, there's no guarantee that it's permanent. The boys have died many, many, many times. And you might hate this, but again, it's kind of an attitude of, and that was the thing people complained about last year. Sam had a death in the end of the season that was resolved by the end of the episode. He was killed and brought back within an episode. With Supernatural, a death is not really about the person dying. A death is about how it affects the characters around them and what basically. It's so established that the lead characters have been killed and will come back, that it's kind of just about okay, how does that death change things now? And because for the guys, it's still very high stakes. And sometimes the story is about that complacency of they've cheated death so many times and what if they can't but they're very much open talking about that, that death on our show is not really about dead forever stakes. It's about change. So it's kind of a metaphor. That's very, very different to The Walking Dead, obviously, where people definitely, it's not a world where people get reincarnated or no.
Well, I guess they do.
And stuff.
But like, the point is that they can become a zombie, right? So that's the. I'm making a joke. Yeah. No, but I referenced Supernatural in my head as being a Dragon Ball Z effect, because the whole purpose of that anime is that they just want to resurrect everybody. So there's a continual loop of everybody dying until they can get their final Dragon Ball wish, and then they resurrect everybody, and then everybody dies again, and it's literally the same thing. So I would not do well with Supernatural. I couldn't deal with it. I could not deal with the resurrections.
Well, you would have to understand that the stakes are not about that. That's not that. Like, there's the thing. If you're viewing it with the stakes being like, oh, we didn't even get time to be sad that Sam died, that was not the point of him dying. Like, that was not the point of it at all. It was about, like, yeah, other things. But, you know, or whatever it is. Like, you know, like, it's a given that it's a different kind of mindset. But if you went into that without that mindset, you would hate it so much.
I watch shows to suffer. Like, I want to cry as a character dies. I do not want them to come back. I want to believe it. And it's weird because, like, I've developed this sort of armor when characters have plot armor, because I can feel when I'm watching like Vampire Diaries, when a character seems like they're dying on screen, you know that Bonnie's coming back. You just know it. It didn't feel real enough. And you know that since Elena's gone, Bonnie's going to have to stick around and do more. So they can't just kill her off. And then she'll be back as a ghost. And then she'll come back. And it ruins the significance of that death scene for me. That's what I need, though.
Interesting. I don't feel the same way at all, but I understand it with something like The Walking Dead. But like Supernatural, for example, had at the end of season 12, like Castiel was killed, and he was killed in a way that the guys certainly didn't think that he was coming back. Like there's a certain way that angels can be killed that is like they're dead. Like, you know, he's like disappeared and stuff before. This was dead, and they burnt his body. Literally, he was gone. And we knew as the audience that he would be back in some way. But even though we knew that, the show still did an amazing job exploring the arc for the guys not thinking that he was coming back, because they genuinely didn't. And it was very affecting. And the point of that arc was to increase Cass's significance in the family, for them to become more like verbalizing their love for each other and being in a, you know, him being at home with them and stuff like that. And the show, like, you know, he's, you know, like in all the promo art, like it's three of them and stuff like that. Like, it's the story kind of is like not about the death so much as about like the significance of what it changes for the character. And in that case, that was it. But The Walking Dead seems like a show where that kind of resurrection is not like literally mythologically possible. Is that right?
Correct. Unless they're a ghost and they come back to haunt Rick, which they often do. Oh, they come back. Yeah, he has his wife, his best friend.
Are they real ghosts? Are they real ghosts or are they hallucinations in his head?
Debatable. Like, the show's not going to ever explain it. It's Supernatural only to a viral degree. Like, it's Supernatural to the degree of they'll make a zombie virus, but they never really go past that. But then again, like, a dismembered zombie head will still be animated, so that's kind of like magic rather than science. So you'd think that they're real ghosts and that it's not just hallucinations from that perspective. You can never tell, because like sometimes you feel like other characters are seeing them, kind of like that effect of like when a character is screaming from the other side and then another character turns to look where they heard the scream and they weren't there in the real world. Like, that kind of thing feels like it happens sometimes. It's so odd, and it's the effect of it's almost a Game of Thrones effect, where you have to try and adapt to, yes, keep your audience interested, but also to the effect of how much material you have left to adapt. Now, I don't really know Game of Thrones and where they're going with the books not being finished and everything, but I do know that they're trying to clean it up as best they can without giving away the book, which is stupid because they've always been based off the books. So, like, I don't know. That's a mess, too.
They work so closely with the author. I am very curious/concerned about that. But anyway, the point is, The Walking Dead, I understand being frustrated by that kind of like those kind of stakes on a show where that kind of death is actually meant to be affecting in that way. And so I would be very annoyed by like the repeated fake outs or basically like cruelly playing on people's emotions. I think that's the thing. Yeah. Supernatural, when lead characters die, and some characters have died and not come back. Like, that's different. But the leads, die, and them not coming back is never a question. And so it's not preying on grief, if you know what I mean. It's not like preying on the fans being like actually like tricking them or anything like that. And so there's definitely none of that for me. And I saw this thing with The Walking Dead and Andrew Lincoln, and I was like, I think Andrew Sims posted about it, and I was like, I don't go here, but that's fucked up. As a viewer, I would be really like, my feelings would be hurt.
Well, the issue is also that
not good about it.
AMC doesn't really have a powerhouse anymore. The Walking Dead is it. They do have a spinoff show, Fear the Walking Dead, and they have The Talking Dead, but that's all based off of this one universe. And if they want to keep it going, they have to find a drastic way to make a totally different plot from the comics. They've done major things too. Like, they've killed off Rick's current love interest in the comics. They've also killed off Rick's child, who is also Carl, who's also very integral to the comics plot. So it's not unheard of that they would change the plot. It's also not unheard of they'd make you suffer like this, because they showed both Glenn and now I always want to call him Andrew Lincoln, Rick, suffering in the show from their injuries, like they're going to die. In both Glenn's, you know, dumpster sequence, and then in Andrew Lincoln's sequence of being run through the side with, I think, a rebar. I try and block it all out. It's horrible. But in Rick's case, he just gets saved, and it's like, you made us suffer, and you put us through that emotional turmoil just to take it away because you thought.
Fine, like stakes, whether someone's gonna die or not on screen is fine.
But playing it up like it's going to be their death is not.
Yeah, I kind of meant, yeah, the performance around it. Like, yeah.
The
PR and the way that people were acting about it, like in panels and stuff like that. I'm like, I don't know what happened behind the scenes with him getting those new movies. Like, maybe he really did think he was leaving for good and then it all changed. I would have no idea.
I don't know what his attachment is to the series anymore. Yeah, I don't know why he would stick into it.
Stakes on screen where someone is like, oh, maybe going to die, and then find out they survived. That's less horrible to me than that PR circus that I saw happen with Andrew Lincoln. I was
offended
by that from afar.
So what was kind of hilarious in this sort of PR circus bit that we're bringing up here, they took Stephen Young's name out of the credits when he had his fake death. Because they really wanted us to believe it. That's the length they went to. I was like, ah. Oh. And I don't even know. I don't watch The Talking Dead, but I am sure they had Stephen Young on then for the interview. And Chris Hardwick was probably like, now that your character is done, how do you feel? Like, I'm sure they sold it off as a complete death. And I am positive that the creator probably went on to say it was an actual death, just to lie to the audience and then bring him back completely alive and completely okay. That's not above what this show's production will do. It's very money-based, and that's it. It wants its viewers because it ran off, but it's not the quality content show that got it its initial viewership, so... They're struggling. They're struggling to maintain onto their viewership. They're struggling to maintain onto their main actors. They're going to have to try to, I guess, focus on what they do have left, as opposed to trying to grasp onto straws to create more. I don't think that more is going to help them at this point. I think they need to stop where they are. Like, completely stopping the show, or, you know, not doing any more spinoffs. Either way, like, it's time to just kind of let this slowly die, bring it out to pasture nicely, make it a happy ending. Why not? Let's cure the zombie virus. That would be fine. I don't think the fandom would be angry at this point. We've suffered enough. The show is just misery porn, and I can't take the fake out misery because it's too much for my little soul. But that's how I feel about The Walking Dead. Brittany, I don't know if you never watched the show either, and have you ever felt this way toward a show you've watched with, like, this kind of fake-out death?
I was just about to butt in and be like, I don't watch any shows that have fake-out deaths, so I don't know. I mean, the closest that it comes is, like, early days Grey's Anatomy, but, like, every death that was coming on there either was, A, genuinely surprising because you didn't know that the actor was leaving the show, or B, just they died and they stayed dead. Like, you knew that they were leaving the show and then they actually killed off a person and they stayed dead. So, like, with Negan, that actor, I know we were talking about him in connection with Supernatural, but, like, you know,
yeah. Also Grey's.
Denny Duquette, when he died, I'm still not over it. So, same. You know, and that was like season one Grey's. So, yeah, I really don't have anything to add because I don't watch shows that have that really built into the structure. And I haven't had to deal with that in a long time, whether I knew something was coming or didn't know.
It's not fun.
If we are going to wrap that conversation up, I will segue into knowing a death is coming and then not being sure whether or not you're going to see something again. And that relates to Broadway shows where, you know, a closing date is coming. However, these shows have been filmed. Can you see them again? Probably not. But I have been very frustrated lately, and I don't know why, because I know that all Broadway shows are filmed, and I know that there are recorded versions, and sometimes you get to see them, and sometimes they live in the vault forever. And I have seen now this year, I saw Bandstand twice in the movie theater. Once over the summer, once again around Veterans Day, they ran it again in the local movies where you could buy a ticket and go watch the filmed version. And both times, very emotional experiences. But you do lose something with that recorded version, which is kind of, you know, frustrating because you are under the director's whim of which characters you're watching when. And I know that when I'm watching a show live in a theater, I like to pick which actor I'm watching on the stage. And it's not always the actor that a director who's filming a stage production is following. Mm-hmm. So that's a little frustrating. However, I have...
Better than nothing.
Exactly. Better than nothing. Exactly. So I recently have seen... I saw Bandstand a few weeks ago, and I saw Frankenstein, the National Theater production of Frankenstein, a few weeks ago. And I've seen both of those recorded versions only. I've never seen either of them live performed on the stage. And leaving both of them, you know, it's, you miss, like, you know, shows that are closed and that you don't get to see or have taken place in another country that you don't get to see. So for example, Frankenstein was in the UK. I didn't get over to the UK to see it. Just as most people who are living in the UK full-time haven't gotten over to the US to see many of the productions that are on Broadway. So I wish that there was like a system in place where it could be X number of years and they'll show them in theaters for like a limited run anywhere in the world. I don't even care if it's here, but if it's somewhere else, like around like Veterans Day, for example, they did Bandstand and they're showing Allegiant, the filmed version of Allegiant, I think next weekend. So like around big anniversaries of things that the shows are related to. So hint, hint, put the Groundhog Day, you know, up every year on Groundhog Day. I'm torn, though.
We've talked about this, you know, a lot of times before, that this film stage production thing is like a bit backwards in terms of a practical way of making theatre accessible. And there's just, you know, there's a lot of roadblocks, like, you know, there's some attitudes, like, especially with producers and, you know, that part of the exclusivity of theatre or part of the experience of theatre is about it being impermanent and about it being, like, in the room. But, I mean, come on, like it feels like it's shooting itself in the foot. Like it feels like, you know, it's not exactly going to like hurt ticket sales, especially if you're talking about after it comes out.
Like I'm not saying put Hamilton up in the theaters right now, but I think Hamilton's performing enough around the world where it is a little bit more accessible. But I'm saying like shows like they did, they put the revival of Falsettos on local broadcast television here on PBS as part of their Masterpiece Theater. They also did the like, you know, filmed version of the Sweeney Todd in Lincoln Center, like limited engagement performances or revivals, or like they show Company, the Company where Stephen Colbert and Neil Patrick Harris were in it. They've shown that a couple times. Like, you know, there's ways to do it where they are still limited in the scope that they're showing them. So like Bandstand was in theaters for 2 days, That's it. Like you had a shot to see it and then that's it. It's over.
It's so strange. Like, I don't know if they really think that like, if it's like artistic, if it's like, oh, we're never going to capture it right it's ruining the integrity, or if it's like they legitimately think it's going to be like, oh, if you can get it on movies, no one will come and see it at the show. I'm like, that's not going to happen. Broadway sales are up. Like, that's not going to happen. Like, it's so, I don't really know. And the fact that the National Theatre does it for nearly every production, especially straight plays, like not musicals, but I don't know why it's a bit more hard with musicals, but National Theatre does nearly every show as a worldwide cinema broadcast. So I don't really understand like what Broadway has against that, but yeah.
Yeah, and you know, like I've said, it's something that I've had like a lot of, you know, thoughts about before, but I think it was seeing Bandstand again that really made it like stick with me again, and I was getting angry, and you know, it's just, I just don't get it, and I wish there was a better system in place so that more people could see shows and appreciate them and get excited about them. And you know, yes, it is up to the director, and like, you know, it's not the same experience, because even when I was watching Bandstand again this time, I'm like, no, I don't want you to stay on this character. I want to see what this person's doing on that part of the stage, because the acting is just so moving, and it makes me kind of frustrated that I didn't get to see it live, because, all right, full disclosure, it was playing the same time as Groundhog Day two streets over, and I just literally couldn't make it to go see any other show while Groundhog Day was up on stage, so it's my own fault. And they closed the same day. So like, it wasn't even like when I was seeing Groundhog Day a couple times during its last few weeks, like I was seeing that show and nothing else was crossing my mind. And now they both, yeah. So it was just on my mind recently, and I'm angry about it and frustrated. And I wish there was a solution that we could come to as a unit. I will happily sit at the negotiation table should they invite me.
yeah.
Yeah, so that's where I'm at with that. It's a very niche concern and anger, but you know, there's shows like in the UK that have been up and down that I've really wanted to see, like Kiss of the Spider Woman, and like, you know, things. I will only pick things that Jamie Parker and Samuel Barnett are in, but you know, yeah, a lot of missed opportunities. I'm not saying put Cursed Child on the big screen, but who knows, yeah, when all productions close, which they probably never will, but in 20 years, maybe put Jamie Parker's beautiful Harry Potter face up on the marquee at my local cinema and I will go see it.
Yeah, I'm with you though, Bray. It's exhausting to watch a theatrical performance, films only concentrating on certain actors, because my favorite effect of being within theater is, oh, you can watch this ensemble member doing their incredible performance while you just kind of hear Hamilton in mid-stage just doing his thing. But then you don't have to really experience him visually. You can feel him. But when you're watching it, you can't. You can't get that feeling of Hamilton in the middle. You're only seeing him. You're not able to see anything else in detail. And it's such a loss on the art form that I get almost why there aren't more. And I do get why they're wanted, because it's so tough to access all of the wonderful shows around the world. I'm happy only experiencing what I do, because I want that magic to be maintained. I want that feeling to be there for me. And that's how I guess I'm a purist in that way, that I feel theater needs to be experienced in real life at all costs. I don't watch. No, I never watch film shows. They distract me with where they're filming it. I'm not involved in what's going on in the story. It's just not interesting to me. It's like, it's a stressful experience, honestly.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think my biggest thing with the Bandstand example was that was the second time that I had seen it. So I saw it over the summer, and you know, thank God that they put a little like screen up during intermission. I also saw it in this is a funny story. I saw it in like a predominantly older retirement town, because that was where one of the theaters was that was screening it. And the audience that was in that theater were my favorite people. I've never felt more connected to an audience in my life, because they were clapping and just vocal about what they were seeing. And it was very touching.
In the cinema, you're talking about
in the movie theater, they clapped after the performances and it was amazing. And then during the intermission, they put a little, like, it's not a real intermission. They put like a screen up so that you can listen to the overture And, you know, the closing song of Act One of Bandstand still gets me choked up just listening to a recorded version. And I was like full on crying the first time I saw it. And I'm like, was happy for like a little break in the movie to collect myself before moving into Act Two. But I think it was because I was so connected to the story watching it the first time that when I went back the second time, I was like, there's this one character. And this moment that was filmed that I don't think I would have gotten seeing a stage production because it was such a close up on the character. His name is Wayne in the show, and he's an ex-Marine. And there's a line where Laura Osnes says that he came back from war and he's being forced with raising kids who don't recognize their dad. And he's playing the trombone live. Like all these actors were playing the instruments that they were playing on screen live in every performance. They either picked them up or reconnected with an instrument they played as a kid, but they were playing live every night. And he like has a break in his face during that line as he's playing the trombone. And I probably would have never seen that on stage because I would have been either too far where my seat was or looking at something else. But that moment in particular stuck with me from the first time I saw it. And when I went back to see it again, I was like, I need to watch Wayne in every single scene.
Yeah, you want to watch the Wayne cut of, yes, the show.
And you know, it's like if you're seeing a Broadway show and, you know, I luckily have the privilege to go and sometimes see a show multiple times, you can follow that actor's track. But, you know, in a filmed version, you only have what you're working with. And and that's fine. I still got a lot out of seeing it.
Oh my God.
The second that time. But
does that not make you think of like every film that you love that like is maybe shot from multiple angles, like, you know, that they do like a couple of different cuts, and then in the edit you might not have seen, like, say that there's like a someone's reaction face or like something like that,
or they're like focusing on the main characters reacting to something on the stage, but meanwhile these actors are like scattered across the stage, but they want a close-up of that scene. And that could be in any movie, like if you know that this group of people is talking and you are like giving news, well, what about like that person who is in the band, but also like just off screen in the cut that they used in the movie because they went with a close shot instead of a wide shot.
Exactly. Yeah.
So again,
there's just so much missed.
There's so much missed, but that's for anything. And I think like filmed versions have their perks, like getting to see Wayne's face during that particular moment in time in that particular performance. He probably never did that again in any other performance, or maybe he did it in every performance. I don't know, but that's what I have to live with. But then at the same time, like maybe he did something on the next night that was even better. You know, it's a moment in time. It's so...
I definitely felt that way about Newsies. Like I felt like that one was done. I feel like that they got the right shots for a lot of Newsies, but there was not... I do know what you mean. Because definitely if I saw like a Les Mis, if I saw like a live filmed... as opposed to the movie, a live stage production of Les Mis with like my various favorite like Broadway people, they would not stay on the characters that I would be watching in the theater. I know that. Like I know that they would not be staying on like members of the group, like the secondary leads or like, you know, like tertiary leads, featured ensemble and stuff like that, that I'm like, I know that character's entire story from the book and I am watching how that actor does that character, you know, like that kind of thing. I know they wouldn't stay on that, so it would annoy me in some cases for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not a huge loss, but it has been something that's been like bugging me lately as I think about like shows, like three shows that I have been wanting to see have announced their closing dates. And it's sort of like, oh, like now I have to try to figure out how I can get to see them because like, who knows if I'll ever be able to see them again, if I don't.
Once on this island.
Once on this island and Head Over Heels. So I need to like get in and see them. And then there are other shows that are up on the stage right now that are limited engagements. They're running for 12 weeks and that's it. You know, like the
Lifespan of a Fact.
Yeah. Lifespan of a Fact. And you know, like there's a lot going on that I want to see, and just, you know, sometimes you don't have time or money to get in to see everything. And I'd spend, and the tickets are more expensive. Like when you go to see a show in the movie theater, you're not paying, like, you can't go on like a discounted Tuesday night. Like, you know, there are events, they're like technically, they're usually like $5 to $6 more than a regular ticket would be. And I'm happy to pay that if I can go and see it here. And it's only like a one-off performance and they're only playing for a week or so. So
yeah. And this is reminding me too of my experiences when I'm watching the like live Hairspray or whatever Grease. I almost wish that that doesn't happen in another way too, because I think it spoils the audience more into expecting just that level. It doesn't make sense to have that, to me, in someone's home. You don't really earn it that way. There's something to be earned in my mind too, in my peers' mind. And I know I'm going against what you two are feeling, it seems, majorly, but I love the experience of knowing like you earned these tickets and your certain seat. And
no, that's check your privilege, Mitch.
Mm-hmm. I know it's a privileged thing. Trust me. I know it's a super privileged thing.
The biggest issue, the biggest core of this problem with film theater is that the reason it's so restricted is because the old school theater industry is so snobby about who they want to be a theater fan. And the biggest perk of this kind of thing is accessibility. So while I totally understand that the experience of like being in a theater is the prime way to do it and that it is not the ideal way to do it filmed, it's kind of like a utilitarian like call to make in terms of like, we support this conceptually because it is something that helps it be more accessible in general.
And yeah, so it definitely spreads the love of theater. Like, that's not a bad thing at all. And it's also a good way to experience like, oh, good hearty entertainment on television that feels good. And I would just be
very careful about using the word earned in that circumstance in terms of like,
I don't mean by money. I mean by the experience of it. And that's a lucky thing to get, which does come with money. So you're right. You know, earned
does come with that connotation. I feel that way. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are involved in the medium of theater that do believe it is like really only worth it in the moment.
Worth it, I think, is the idea. Yeah.
You know, that transience is part of the beauty. And it is. It's just, this is kind of like the best we can do to help.
Yeah.
Spread it. I don't know.
But there is something else that I would like to hype that doesn't care what shot they get. They'll use it on a first take. They don't care if it's a wide shot. They don't care if half the background actors are still on their coffee break. They don't care if the CGI snow makes sense in the moment.
I just realized what you were saying halfway through.
And so I'm going to hype about Hallmark Christmas movies for just a little bit here and just say that they're not perfect. They're far from perfect. They don't care if they're perfect. They're going to produce 38 of them in a given season and you're going to like it and watch every single one of them across two networks. Yeah. I am in the throes of Hallmark Christmas movie season. It is December 2nd when we are recording this. Hallmark Christmas movies have been on since October 26th, and I have been watching them since October 26th. I have seen the old standbys from 2011 on that I love and cherish. I have a DVR now, so they are all recorded. And I've seen, I would say, almost all of the new ones. There's one premiering in 20 minutes, but I have hit record on it so that way I can watch it as soon as we are done podcasting. I'm into it. I love it so much. I have a lot of people at work who will talk to me about one they caught over the weekend. I have people texting me like sweatshirts that they're finding on Etsy that are like, this is my Hallmark movie watching shirt. So, you know, it's a lifestyle, one that I'm committed to and enjoy deeply. I am not a housewife or a retired woman who, you know, doesn't have anything better to do with her time. I'm a very active and busy millennial adult, and I find Hallmark movies very soothing, and I love that they're on 24 hours a day.
My friend Megan Fitzmartin, who is someone who I will hopefully host on this podcast sometime coming up soon, because she has a project I am keen to speak to, and I think that you would be very interested to speak to her too, Brittany. she was saying something on Twitter the other day about Hallmark movies. She was like, they fill the same like mental niche as a lot of, you know, non-explicit fan fiction, like Fight Me. And I very much agreed with her on this, and we had a conversation about it in terms of the emotional experience, because like a lot of people like seek out fan fiction not because, you know, they care about the fan, well, you know, lots of times it is because they care about the fandom and the character. That's a given. But the difference between like reading a fan fiction, and I agree, I think that this extends to these kind of movies, and watching or, you know, reading an original novel or original movie or something like that, is the promises made going in terms of the mindset. Like, you know that you're seeking something on purpose that will have the payoff that you want it to. It's not like a free fall of like an emotional turmoil that you're not expecting. It's got like a, like, you know, and certain fan fiction is certainly traumatic, but like there is a, you know, certain genre of fan fiction, especially, which is becomes evident, like if they tag it with certain things, where like even though you don't know exactly how the story is going to unfold, you know that you're going to leave it like with the satisfaction that you're expecting. And I think that that's like the niche that Hallmark movies fill a lot of the time in terms of entering it knowing, you know, you said soothing, like, and knowing it like that it's, there's a comfort level that it's not going to like take you on a wild trauma that you weren't expecting. It's not like a free fall where you have to get swept up in the story. It is a very big safety net of like, you know, you don't necessarily know how things are going to happen, but you know that there are rules for your emotions that will be taken care of, basically.
Yeah, and they still manage to slip in a few surprises every now and then. Like sometimes the couple gets together halfway through the movie and then there's like a miscommunication and, you know, then you know what you're prepared for the second hour, or the couple is not together at the halfway point in the movie, so you also know what you're prepared for in the second hour. And I'm also pretty convinced, and I became convinced of this during the viewing of one particular movie where the woman in question, this is a new one for this year. It's about when they're baking Kringles for the town and like the corporate guy comes in and is just like, we should automate this. And they're like, no, but the handcraftedness, it ruins everything. Anyway, so the guy comes into town and he like learns that like, you know, actually hand making these crinkle cakes is a good idea. And there's this guy who this woman used to date, and he, you know, he's clearly still smitten with her, but she just wants him to move on and like find love. And he does eventually get with her friend, spoiler alert, asks her if it's okay if he goes out on a date with her friend, his coworker, whatever. But I'm like 99% convinced that no one in any Hallmark movie ever has had sex, because it's just like never on the table. It's never like a thing that's addressed, and everything is so sweet and innocent. And first of all, every single Hallmark movie is rated G. So
really?
That. Every single one.
It's wild.
What about what about like the Netflix Christmas movies? Are they
PG? They might be PG, but they're also still probably G. Like there's in genre. Although I really think I did watch on premiere night, of course, the Christmas Prince 2, The Royal Wedding. Incredible.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh man, settle in, because it is nothing. It is everything you expect it to be and nothing you expect it to be. There's like a surprise, like, plot line that I was so into. I was like, this is this every movie that thinks it deserves a sequel needs to watch The Christmas Prince and then The Christmas Prince 2, because they did it right.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
It's
unbelievable.
I'm excited, and I really need to start tapping into some of these, because I need to get a hold of The Christmas Contract. Have you seen that one yet?
Oh, yes, I have. I've seen
it. Did you like it?
I loved it.
Yeah, well,
I've never seen One Tree Hill, though. So it wasn't honestly, the Hallmark movie starring Chad Michael Murray, A Road to Christmas, also huge, must-see television, because Chad Michael Murray has this confused what is happening to me look on the entire movie and is not dressed for the weather in any scene ever filmed in a snowstorm. It's fantastic.
Christmas Contract is, I have not seen One Tree Hill either, but Danielle Ackles, who's Jensen Ackles' wife.
Yes, she is
like,
in it.
my number one favorite person involved in the entire Supernatural community. She is the coolest person I have ever met. I love her. I'm obsessed with her. And she is in it. And I don't think her role is very big, but I need to see it.
It was very great. I mean, it's very, again, formulaic and wonderful.
Yeah.
But you know what you're getting? Again, it's that comfort of, I know that when I come home from work and I say Hallmark into my very fancy new remote, which is like really cool. I think in my remote though, only it's like voice activated. And I think it thinks the only three words I know are Hallmark and movies and mysteries, because there's also a Hallmark movies and mysteries channel. Those are the only three things I say to the remote. And you know, it's just the comfort of knowing what you're getting. You can tune in 45 minutes into the movie. You can tune in an hour and a half into the movie. You can tune in at the beginning. You know what you're getting. Netflix has done also a great job. The Princess Switch feeds every little thing that you need. Bad accents, made up countries, you know, costumes that are just ridiculous and over the top. Also on Netflix is Christmas Inheritance, which is like probably better than A Christmas Prince, but I'm not willing to admit it yet. I've seen it a couple times. It's very good. It's just, there are so many great things about Hallmark Christmas movies and how bad they are, but they're actually at the end of the day not bad. They're just following this very hyper specific formula that is wonderful and endearing. And the only person I would ever want to talk to, I was really thinking about this today as I was trying shopping and looking for things to decorate my own apartment for Christmas, is I want to talk to a set decorator from a Hallmark Christmas movie, because I don't know how they do it, making these towns and festivals, and forget everything about the acting and the writing. It's the set decorators who are doing God's work for these films. So kudos to them. If any Hallmark set decorators listen to this, please get in contact with me, because I really want to pick Brittany,
But the set decorators in Hallmark movies, they do a lot with food.
Like, they who's
the food consultant on Hallmark?
Who is the food consultant, and who is that good at making fake gingerbread houses? Like, I don't know. Who can make snowmen? I don't know. Who can make all these reeds? Like, the towns are so hyper specific and like really focused on one element of it. Like, these people are brilliant bakery designers. Like, I want someone to come into my small town and build a bakery, because that's how every bakery should look. Like, they give me false expectations for how bakery should look. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just the decoration, the lights, the bookshops, everything is so perfect and cute and wonderful. And I,
do towns like this exist?
Yes,
do they have like a dedicated lot, or do they usually go to a small town and be like, we're making a movie here?
Well, they're all filmed in Canada in like June, so it's hot.
Oh, okay.
And there's a lot of fake CGI snow, because that's why the characters are also in like really light outerwear. And I'm like, it is a blizzard and all the airports are closed. You definitely would not be dressed like that, but okay, fine. So yeah, it's they're all filmed in like Vancouver, and the best is like when they're filmed in New York, in air quotes. They're not. But yeah, and I love my favorite. Okay, one last note about Hallmark movies, then we will move on. But my favorite thing is when a character comes in from Chicago or New York or Dallas. It doesn't even matter what the city is. And they're like, oh, well, you're from the big city. Every time. Big city is thrown around like a curse word in these movies. Everyone hates the big city. No matter what city it is. It could be Cleveland. It could be Philly. It could be like Shanghai. You are from the big city, sir, and you are not welcome.
I really loved, I was talking to you on Twitter about this, Britt. I loved Sharing Christmas so much. Oh, it made me cry.
Oh, Sharing Christmas is fantastic. There's also one where this woman has to go into the city, and like her family, what they do is they sell the Christmas trees and like the lots around the city. Oh, that one's also fantastic.
Oh, is that the one where she also is going to lose the business?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Everyone's going to lose a business.
Always going to lose the business.
Always
going to lose the business. And who's going to save Christmas? That's all I want to know.
If there is one point set of leftover, that family's whole savings is tanking. Like, they need to sell every last point set of they own. Otherwise, the farm is going back to the bank.
it is such a joyous experience. I love watching these.
So we're done with Hallmark Christmas movies because I could talk about them forever. And instead, we're going to talk about 2D animation because that's a thing that we're excited about, right, Mitch? I guess.
Is it?
It's a thing. We're excited about it.
I think this is a twisted gripe on the Lion King for some reason.
Well, yeah, you could. But I'm going to go with, I really like that there is sort of a resurgence of this Miyazaki animation. And if anyone's not familiar with Miyazaki, the name, you might be familiar with the movies like Ponyo or Spirited Away, The Secret Garden of Arrietty. They're very fairy tale-y and they're very
the production company's called Studio Ghibli. That people kind of know that.
More than Miyazaki, perhaps. Sometimes they do, you're right.
Oh, no, both. But yeah, Studio Ghibli is that style. That's the
Neighbor Totoro. Yeah. So there's a sort of resurgence in 2D animation as other artists seem to emulate his style. And it's really working out well for me because I cannot get enough of these Studio Ghibli movies. And now I'm pretty much getting them all the time. Matter of fact, there was a Pokemon movie that just came out recently called Pokemon The Power of Us. And this movie actually looks like a Studio Ghibli movie at many times. And it also acts like one. It feels like it because the best part about these movies of that style now is that they have like this little subtle interaction feeling to them that nothing's ever really important as they're talking or moving and doing their things, but everything is really in depth. Like you'll see characters do like little like conversation ticks toward each other that won't be fully explained, but you're just understanding that, yeah, there's like a fuller conversation to be had here. If you really wanted to get in depth and see like what their character backstories were, we could. But in the meantime, it's just a whimsical way of seeing, oh, they have a deep relationship. And it's also in the fact that the animation almost makes it look like they're actors because they don't do it perfectly. Like it's not animated perfectly. Every sequence has like little bits where just, it's not like they're saying the lines wrong or anything, but it's like they just don't look like perfect cartoons. They're meant to have flaws. And I love this. I love that all of it's making it feel very realistic now. And it's not just in this Pokemon movie. I've seen this in many other just like animes that I've seen on TV recently. And I think that it's just the best thing ever because I didn't have this as a child. I always wanted this as a child, but all I really had were like the original Pokemon anime or the Dragon Ball Z anime or anything else that you guys might not know, like One Piece, but it's not there anymore. We're not to that lower level of animation where you can kind of cookie cutter it together. You don't really add an in-depth character study in there. That's all that these movies are now. 2D animation movies, they're just in such a beautiful resurgence. And I think that as we're going to look back on this period of time, that we're going to look back and see that there was this amazing resurgence of 2D animation. Voltron's another big show coming out like this. The other one, The Dragon Prince from the creators of The Last Airbender is also something that's getting into the same vein as this. There isn't enough good animation there's too much good animation to even try and catch up on. It's great. It's a great problem to have. And I can't wait to just dig more in depth into, I'm going to watch The Dragon Prince tonight, actually. I'm going to check it out and I'm going to see what kind of avatar feels it gives me. So I'm super happy right now.
I am interested to see what you think of The Dragon Prince. I loved it.
You watched it?
Yeah, I watched it when it first came out. It was great. I really, really liked it. So I'm curious to see what you think.
I mean, seeing as Avatar The Last Airbender is my favorite TV show of all time, I'm nervous because I'm like, oh, it's such a legacy to live up to in my head.
And yeah, go on.
I was just going to say, I wouldn't hold Avatar as the bar. I mean, there are certain like familiarities, but it's a very different story.
Everything about the mythology, and I've only seen a little bit of it, I can see big similarities, but also like the world building is just not the same.
Yeah.
The intro of like what happened in the world is very much that kind of stylistic intro of like, you know, the Avatar intro.
Yeah, that felt very Avatar.
That feels the same, but as it goes on, and like Jack DeSena's voice kind of plays into it a bit, like, you know, as the Like, he sounds like himself. He sounds like Sokka. So there
he's back. I didn't know that. That's cute.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's one of the leads. And it's, you know, it's just, you can see the DNA, but it's just, but it's the same as like how every Disney 2D animation is kind of the same kind of face style and, you know, all that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah, no, that's that. Well, it's also a level of quality, much like I'm referencing with the Miyazaki quality that I think we can now start to see in different genres that are evolving. Like, this is the Last Airbender quality, or this is Disney quality, as you put. And it's a shame.
It's certainly a style. You know, it's a style that is of that house. You know, of that production. That DNA of that those creators. So yeah, it's right. I mean, it is a really nice, interesting kind of show, you know?
Well, it's a shame only in that Disney seems to have lost interest in their 2D animation. They seem like I think they've even done away with that animation studio, or if anything, they've evolved the entirety of it to just 3D animation. So that's like Wreck-It Ralph or Moana as of late. And that's a shame because, like, Princess and the Frog, I think, as far as I remember, was the last 2D animated movie. It was fantastic, and I'm just left here wanting more. It's almost like there was, like, a power vacuum in 2D animation, and other studios stepped up, and they were like, we're going to take it over from where Disney left off. We're going to improve it, and we're going to bring it into the 21st century.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't have all of the, you know, answers about that kind of shift from 2D to 3D. My understanding from a design point of view is that hand-drawn single, you know, hand-drawn 2D animation is kind of like harder to do now than 3D, because for 3D you can just build a model of a character and then program it to move, as opposed to having to draw every frame.
Well, it's, so yeah, 3D, it's that art style, it's that 3D commitment to it that now. I love.
But I don't know if, you know, they're going to carry on with any 2D ones. I didn't think Princess and the Frog was the last one.
I understood it as being, because I've been involved in this world enough to, I feel like, hear of that before. I'm happy to be wrong. I want more 2D.
You might be right. You might be right. I'm just not sure, like, yeah, how that, yeah, if they're going to continue on in that direction or not.
We can cross our fingers, but I don't see Disney doing it, because they're doing so well with Frozen and just like anything, like I think Brave was Pixar, but anything Pixar as well. It's not even Disney Animation Studios they have coming in. They don't really need to spend the time that they used to on these, but it's almost as if they're able to put in double the output in a way, because they do still put a lot of hard work into movies like Finding Dory, for instance, Pixar does. But then again, those movies look beyond beautiful. I feel like to get that level of quality in a 2D animation, you have to wait longer. So there's that. There's another positivity there, but it's not like 2D animation is dying or going anywhere, as I think many might believe. It's still very strong, and surprisingly so, even to myself in this day and age, and I couldn't be any happier. So if anybody's interested in checking out any of those shows, you pretty much can't go wrong. You're going to love especially what Netflix has to offer. They're doing a lot of really interesting original anime as of late. Kakaguri is one that I've been touting for a while, and it's one of which focuses on a gambling high school. And the animation is so much fun. It's so unique. I've never seen a show like it. It's so exaggerated. Every character has such big movements. And I guess in a way it might feel theatrical. It's super fun. So just browse your 2D animation segment on Netflix or you know, any sort of kids shows, I would even say, on the Netflix browsing, and you might find some awesome surprises in there.
I seem to remember that they were doing Tangled was originally pitched as 2D and they switched to 3D. So something might have happened at Disney, like with that 2D to 3D shift, because I remember the 2D concept art for Tangled, and then it didn't happen. So
Tangled is a 2D animation show, yeah, but it's probably computer animated, because it doesn't really look like it.
Oh yeah, yeah, it wouldn't be hand drawn. You can still do that 2D animation digitally.
Yes,
it's just not quite the same as building a 3D model and programming it to move. Like 3D animation is now like something that people have kind of got on lock cheaply. So, like, you know, see all those kids' cartoons that are, like, creepy, weird 3D animation stuff. I mean, Nickelodeon still does so much 2D, though, right? Like, Brittany?
Yeah, kind of. Cartoon Network does, too, a bit. With like We Bare Bears and Teen Titans Go, they're all 2D.
Steven Universe.
SpongeBob is still kicking, even with the loss of Steven Hillenburg. It's in its 12th season. So, like shows like Fox and, you know, like all the cartoons there. Family Guy, I think, is computer drawn, but like, you know, The Simpsons is still on and Bob's Burgers. So there's still a lot going on.
Yeah, and I think we even recently, we can plug this in our notes, did an article with Karen touting it. She was gathering us all together to give out our favorite shows. I think I did Kakuguri, and then Brittany, did you do Bob's Burgers as yours?
No, I did BoJack.
You did BoJack. Yeah, hey, another show on Netflix. So, that's a 2D animation.
Fantastic. I could not speak more highly of BoJack Horseman. I think, though, the shows are still very small in their following.
Yeah.
I think because we like them and are looking around, they're popular in our inner watching circles, and people we follow are liking them because they like the same things we do. So I think a big thing, too, especially with shows like BoJack, I'm like, oh, yeah, BoJack's so popular. It's really not. It's popular among writers. Who cover television for a living.
It's really, kind of like that high level of like, subversive, like kind of.
It's popular in my inner circle. It's not popular.
Think about television for people who think about television, like professionally.
Basically. Yeah. It's really not popular though. And you know, like everyone knows The Simpsons, but if I walked up to the everyman on the street and was like, do you watch BoJack Horseman? They'd be like, what? And it's in its like sixth season, so you know it's or about to have its sixth season, so it's you know, it's a very niche group of people. And I think the cartoons like She-Ra, the Dragon Prince, they're even more niche. Like I don't think that the people who are watching and writing and loving BoJack are watching the Dragon Prince at all.
Well,
there might be some crossover, but it's not like they're waiting for a show like that to come out if they haven't already been invested in an avatar or.
And that already, that like also, that actually flips back to what I was talking about in terms of like that audience, that shift in television creativity and what's allowed. There is definitely what everything I was saying earlier about my gripe also ties into the, changing way that shows are distributed or the changing ideas of success going from this show that we're creating, like Simpsons or whatever, you know, whatever show on broadcast. We have to make this show liked by everyone. And now it's kind of flipping to this thing where we're like, we're going to make a lot of shows so like a few people can like something. You know, like as in it's kind of slipping through one structure that everyone has to subscribe to, or, you know, one kind of style or format or tone that everyone has to kind of like, this is what you get and you're going to like it. And then we're kind of flipping around to like, we are making something for everyone, especially something like, you know, when it's a Netflix original production, when they're producing all of these things and they're getting subscription money. You know, like they're it's in their interest to make more niche things that, like, you know, they're not kind of trying to sell it to every single person. They're trying to sell a lot of things. They're trying to cater to a lot of people individually, like in terms of creating something that's like might be really appreciated by a small niche group of people who are going to pay Netflix to get to see it, you know, like, and then, you know, there's another small niche group of people, same amount of people overall, but like different amounts of niche content for them. And I think that's a big factor in what you're talking about and in terms of that shift of audience appreciation, like that we're basically breaking stuff down to be more niche and more sophisticated and individual as opposed to presenting like one format for everyone. and it's having a big knock-on effect in that way in terms of everyone finding their niche, I guess.
I think that's a great point, and also brings us kind of into what you want to talk about finding your niche and bringing back shows that were wildly successful on TV when they probably had no right to be successful on TV because the culture was very different. But now are back and gaining such a big following on social media and on Netflix. Let's talk about the new Fab Five, Natalie.
Yeah. So my hype right now is Queer Eye, and it could have been a gripe. My gripe could have been that I slept on Queer Eye. I just didn't have the energy to engage with a lot of things. And now I have recently started watching Queer Eye because I, you know, everyone have been like, oh, it's so healing. It's so beautiful. It's so amazing. You know, and I'm like, it can't possibly be that good. And I loved the first one for what it was at the time when I was like 18. Like I watched on television. I had the books. I thought it was really like you like the lifestyle books. I thought it was really cool, like, you know, for what it was at the time. This is just a million times beyond anything I could have expected. It's so beautiful for so many reasons, and a lot of those reasons are many of those things that we've just talked about. Like, part of it is, like, this, yeah, the tone and the openness of, you know, of people, the fact that they were willing to make this show, you know, and put these things kind of out into the world, put these stories out into the world, and that they were allowed to be so free with it. Like, it's very, you know, it's very high quality production, but it's very kind of loose and personal and not like so performed. But yeah, Queer Eye is making and breaking my heart at the moment. I cry every episode. I'm not finished yet. I just started the second season with the Mama Tammy episode. So that's the
most recent one I saw.
Oh,
geez. And that one almost killed me.
And I just, I do. I cry nearly every time. And I am just amazed at kind of that they've found these guys. And it's kind of a really nice look at how, like, yeah, gay culture in the public eye has progressed since the first, you know, first one. And I love them all for different reasons, but I love that they let the show be, basically. Like, they let them deal with, like, emotional reactions, not just from the clients or the subjects, but from the guys. Like, we've had quite a few episodes that completely unperformed have had these kind of different crisis points for the guys themselves and their relationships with each other or their relationship with the clients. And it's just very moving. It's just very, very moving, the way that they treat each other and the way that they are so, like, sweet and natural and amazing and loving. Again, the old one was fine, but it's just such a sign of, like, what we are comfortable with or what we want to be comfortable with in the way that the tone of, because what they're doing has not really changed. They're getting a subject and they are working with them on developing aspects of their life that need help with in a makeover kind of way. But I don't know, like, you guys have seen it, I assume. Brittany, you've seen it. Mitch, have you seen it?
You know, much like Gilmore Girls, I had to reclaim that from an ex because I started watching it with him. Same thing with Queer Eye. I haven't yet been able to reclaim it. I got halfway through season two. It's not like that it's a sore subject for me. It's like, it just feels like another period of my life. Like, you know how 2018 was just like 10 years? That was just like, that was probably like 5 years of my 2018, the period where I watched Queer Eye.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was a long year. I know a lot of what you're saying, of course, from having watched one and a half seasons of it. And yeah, Mama Tammy is the one that got me too. Season one made me cry more. It made me cry a lot more so far.
I cried many times in season one.
Yeah, but didn't expect to. I never knew what I was getting into. Just thought it was going to be a fun, niche thing.
Are you too young to remember the first one?
Maybe? No, I did watch it with my parents, actually. We would turn it on. We'd watch that. We'd watch Stacey and Clint's What Not to Wear. We would watch Will and Grace. So we watched a lot of gay things in my household growing up. They must have known something I didn't, because I was like 8 when that show was on. There was no queer eye. But I still remember some original tips for the original show.
Oh, like, Mitch. How old are you, Mitch?
I'm 26.
You can't have been 8 when... Anyway, carry on.
Wasn't I?
I don't know. I'm not good at math. Maybe in the earliest. I don't remember. Carry on. Sorry.
I totally remember tips, and I love the tips in the end still of the new show. The old show had ones that were like, one of them was, it stuck with me, two of them actually. First was always use hair products starting from the back of your hair. And then the second one was never put down as many chairs as the people that you have at your party, because you want them to be up and moving rather than all sitting and being bored. The show has like all of these cute little things just thrown into it, and you learn so much about yourself watching it. I still love the episode where there's the guy who doesn't sing anymore and he wants to, and it could have been Jonathan explaining to him, when you lose a part of your creative self, you start to act out in other ways because you're not getting
the, was the Mama Tammy episode.
That
was her gay son.
Yeah, that was her son.
But I just have a lot of feelings about the way everything is presented and how, like, comparing it to the first one. And they kind of said that at the start. They were like, you know, the first one was all about, like, acceptance, you know, like, was all about, like, kind of in terms of, like, getting, you know, hetero queer relationships working. Like, they kind of said in the first episode that, you know, the first series was all about, like, you know, recognition, and now we're more about, like, acceptance. And it's just been interesting to me, both in how it's handled, like the fact that they've chosen like Atlanta as the home base for all of the cities, for all of the stories. And that's not exactly the most, like, you know, they're not doing it in New York, you know, like it's a very kind of, it's still a little bit of a fish out of water situation. But, you know, obviously to be on the show, you would have had to have been like fine with gay people and everything like that. But they've still had a lot of, you know, cultural differences with a lot of the people that they've seen. So there's that. I love the way that they've actually handled, like, you know, 5 gay guys coming to help people in a way that's not like a gimmick. I also love the way that they've actually approached the clients, like with the hair and the clothes and stuff, in terms of it's like, much more conscious of being kind about someone's existing circumstances, as opposed to, like, you know, oh honey, no, about their entire life. You know, it's not really a shame. There's no shame in this show at all, and I love that. You know, I love how open and loving the guys are with each other, and how playful they are, and how natural it seems. Like, it's very unperformative. And I love that they've had so many moments where the guys have had to come to terms with something, like Karamo and the cop was a lot. It was like that's, they would not have done something like that on the first show. And you know, and Bobby's various troubles with religion and all of that kind of stuff. And the guy of Indian background that Tan was kind of talking about his like family cultural things with. And it's just a really honest and like pure loving show. And I was so happily surprised. And they all have amazing qualities to them, the guys. And I'm kind of, one of the, my favorite things that I've seen, and I've seen this since before I watched the show, it's probably one of the reasons that I started watching the show, was that, like, not in like a creepy fan fiction way, but like writing like little funny, like, you know, Tumblr posts about like the Queer Eye reacting to, Queer Eye Fab Five reacting to, like, you know, a fictional character, you know, like Steve Rogers or something like that, Dean Winchester, has been really amusing to me. Like watching, like kind of like thinking about like how they would stereotypically handle like that, those kind of situations in this kind of like very funny, harmless little fan fiction way really amused me. And I've seen some like funny pictures and stuff. And so I'm loving it. I love all of the guys for different reasons.
Like, one thing that is different about the Queer Eye now is, like, I watched the first season. I got so excited about it. I immediately followed them all on Instagram. And then 2 weeks later, I unfollowed all of them except Jonathan, because it was so much. And I felt like I was losing a bit of what made the show so special by overindulging in them. And so I slowly started unfollowing some of them, and I was like, okay, maybe it's just a little too much. And then like I left Jonathan on, and it was a lot because they were together a lot. They were doing press. They were still filming, you know, like, So I really felt like I was getting the whole picture just in a smaller dose, because what would happen is they were filming all this stuff together. So like you would see it 100 times. And so I'm like, okay, I need to cut it out. And I'm really glad that I still just follow Jonathan, because he's been going on this like journey of learning to ice skate, which is one of his passions. And he is bad. He's bad. And he's doing,
oh my God.
Yeah. I'm watching it over the last like 3 weeks, and he has been doing so well. And I just feel like a personal cheerleader in his journey. And then, you know, his idol is Michelle Kwan. And then she posted a video of her just working out and training, wearing one of his sweatshirts. And it was like, he was like so just genuinely pure and emotionally reactive to seeing that. And like, he's just so excited that she's following his journey. And you see like other celebrities just like taking so much from their stories and like, you know, commenting on Jonathan's like ice skating post, being like, you're doing so well, such an inspiration. And it's like, Anderson Cooper and Kelly Ripa are commenting on, you know, it's like you see like all everyone like responding to them as humans for just being who they are and showing what they're interested in. And I really like that aspect of it. It's not all like promotional and like, I have a product. Like, yeah, Jonathan has like t-shirts and stuff, but he's just like, whatever. Like, I'm also ice skating and like doing this really fun stuff. We're just like waking up, and he makes like really funny voices for his cats. And like, he's like, weather update from Frank, and like does like follows his cat around the apartment. And you know, it's like, they're just funny and sweet, and you really, that comes across in the show, and it doesn't feel fake.
The personality blend is kind of incredible. Like, they really lucked out. And that's kind of like in the Mama Tammy episode, like, I am Anthony, by the way, like I am, like, aside from how beautiful he is, his personality,
he's like a lot. He's too beautiful. Like, sometimes I feel like I can't look at him.
He's the most attractive man I've ever seen. That's not what I'm talking about. His behavior, the fact that he's not that playful with them, but sometimes he like has his own insane playful quirks, which just like seem to surprise everyone. Like, he really is he's like very intense about things, and he gets like very like, his personality behavior is so, it is hashtag relatable. Like, I wish I was a Bobby, but I'm an Anthony. And I just love that he's like, he takes things very seriously. He doesn't handle being teased very well. And when he is being playful, and when he is playful in his own way, it's kind of like this really like offbeat, like, situation the others find kind of amusing, which I have definitely seen happen.
Oh my God, when he has the eyeliner on, Natalie.
Or like when he wanted the fire hat, and they're like, really, you want that? And he was like, yeah. But in the Mama Tammy episode, when she, like, because the others are all very like emotional in various parts, and Mama Tammy says, like, at the end, she was like, I know that like this like started before all of us, like, you know, God makes sure to bring you all together, and he just burst into tears, and I burst into tears at the same time. Like, it was just the same, same emotional reaction there. And I'm like, yeah, that's definitely what got me too. But like, they're all very different. Like, Karamo, I wish was my therapist. I think
more of him in season 3, because I just need like a full episode of him just talking.
Counseling someone. I think Tan is really sweet and insecure in a way that I really love. Like, he reminds me a lot of Nick Grimshaw, the BBC host that I like, in this kind of like very like cute, like, ridiculous British funny way that's also like kind of shy. And I really like him. I know he's not very like camera ready. Like, he had not done anything like presentery or anything before that, so he can be a little bit awkward, but I find that very genuine. Bobby, his whole life story is just incredible. Like, I'm just like floored by everything about him, including the work he pulls off like every week. But I love him, and I love the focus on him. And yes, Tam, Anthony, Bobby, Karamo. Jonathan is like a lot, but I love when he's not a lot as well. Yeah. Like I love like when he's actually working and being not insane. Like his insanity is too much for me. Like I would not handle it very well. I would just be like, I can't, like this is too much. Slow, please. But when it's like toned down a bit, or when he snaps out of it, when he's got his own quirks but is actually being serious about his work or being serious about someone else's work as well, like actually, you know, philosophizing on something, he's very good. Like he's very smart, and again, like he's very good with what he does in terms of looks and hair and all of that kind of thing. And especially since they don't always do like white people's hair, you've seen like a lot of the a couple of the black people who they've done have, you've clearly seen this look in their eyes of like, is this guy going to fuck up black hair? And he does not fuck up black hair. He's really adaptable to like knowing what he's doing. And his, again, like his belief in the way that him and Tan both have this great attitude about the physical makeovers that they do that are really unshaming, and that they're really like, you know, they're about maximizing the best of someone and without any kind of real shame on the fact that they are making them over and changing them. I know, I really love them all. It's been great. I feel like very dependent on them as therapy, so I need some more. But I was very shocked by how overwhelmed I was by like just everything about the tone, like that naturalistic, like very honest, like, yeah, kind aspect to it that is, yeah, I'm not surprised that everyone loves them so much, because they're, yeah, you can, there's ways and ways to make a reality show, like in a lifestyle show, that really feel slick or not slick or honest and not honest, and they have just made the most genuine, fantastic thing. So, yeah. Who is your favorite, Brittany? Is it Jonathan? Is
it all? It's Jonathan.
Well,
like, I don't know. I don't want it to be. My favorite thing about the show actually though is this like ongoing unspoken joke that like all these people, like, you know, Tan takes them shopping one afternoon and, you know, Karamo talks to them while they're driving somewhere, or like Jonathan just takes them to the salon, and then Bobby is busting his ass at the house, painting things, sanding things, putting wallpaper up, buying furniture. Like,
and he's, I just mean, like, he has a team, but yes, I like that joke as well. But I really love when they talk about Bobby.
I know, I'm so happy
more when he gets to go on like trips with the others.
Yeah. When he's involved.
Or when they're dealing with his personal stuff, like, you know, with the church, or like, you know, his marriage, or like he like left his home at like 15 and like he's totally self-made, and like he's got the most incredible life, and he's clearly done a lot of like had a lot of inner processing to do, and he's just amazing. And yeah, I love him. Like, I wish I could be him. And him and Karamo are like life goals for self-actualization, but I really loved, I love him, and I love them all, you know. And yeah, before I watched the show, I saw a lot of people like talking shit on the food that Anthony made, like for them and stuff. And I feel offended by that, because like they keep being like, oh, all he does is avocados. I've seen him do stuff with avocados like once, maybe twice, but also he's not teaching these people to be like chefs. He's teaching them to like do something
within their like
something capability. Within their limit, yeah. Or learn about what they want to do. You know, like a lot of the times it's like, you know, I'm going to go talk to that person's mom about the like food that he says that he likes, that he would like to be able to make, you know, like it's totally fine and lovely. And I love his perspective on a lot of things as well. But his slight grumpiness and inability to be teased, mixed with his own weird quirks, I feel very relatable to him. And whenever he cries, I cry. Not because he's crying. We just end up crying at the same things. So I enjoy him. I really enjoy them all. So It's great. I'm looking forward to Jonathan in season two because I really loved him in the Mom and Tammy episode because I think he knew that he could not get away with being Jonathan. As extra as sometimes he is. And so he was kind of like still super himself, but not naughty. And the naughtiness is a bit much for me. I'm a bit exhausted by energy sometimes and he has a lot. So,
oh, that's a good way of putting it, his naughtiness. Ah, I love it.
Yeah, but he's great. They're all great. He's going to have a stand-up tour. Tan and Anthony, I'm kind of like, well, I would have liked to be in New York, but like they hosted like the Dear Evan Hansen book tour in New York, like how they had guest actors in different, guest hosts in different cities for the Dear Evan Hansen book tour. Apparently their friends, Anthony, I think especially, is friends with like a lot of Broadway people. So they were there and were the guest hosts for that. And yeah, I just like them. They've done a little, have you seen the mini episode they did in Australia?
Yes, I saw that. And then they're also on an episode of Nailed It, which is great.
What? Were they?
Yeah, there's like a Christmas, like not Christmas, oh but God. Like an extra episode of Nailed It. And they have to like, it's so funny. They have to like, they're like quick challenge. It's only one challenge, but they have to go and like grab a, like a fondant created like version of each other. And they have to like, it's so funny. It's so funny. Bobby gets so into it. It's amazing.
Yeah. I love, it's great. Anyway, so I'm a big fan of all that. I'm glad we have it. I'm glad that that kind of like natural, in general, like, you know, one of the things in media, I'm appreciating that like people in both scripted television and reality television are allowed to have this kind of naturalistic tone and that we are kind of getting away from that veneer of media, of entertainment a bit. Like, you know, it still exists, but see more and more where like the tone is changing to being slightly less performative in fiction and in reality television. And I'm just really here for that. And this I love so much. So yeah.
Yeah, everybody should go and binge it and learn everything you can about the Fab Five. But if you want to learn about me, we're going to do a little segment that we do on here called Two Truths and a Lie, where every episode our lead host gives two truths and a lie, and their dear friends, the other hosts, get to guess if they are being truthful with one thing and lying about the other. So you guys ready?
I'm ready.
I think I picked a pretty good topic. I think I did. So I have two truths and a lie in the category of which celebrity groupings have I seen in person? So these,
what, like, okay, clusters, I'm ready for this.
These clusters of people that I consider celebrities, I have seen them together within one day.
Okay.
Are we ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So, group number one, Kevin Bacon, Gordon Ramsay, David Boreanaz. Group two, Emma Thompson, Neil Patrick Harris, Meryl Streep, Stephen Sondheim. Group number three, the Swedish Chef, Kermit the Frog, Gonzo the Great.
So that one's just real.
We're talking about in person.
I have seen these people in the same day as I physically saw them.
Yeah, like wouldn't that happen on a tour? The last one? Like I feel like they would have to be together, right, Natalie?
I guess maybe like a Thanksgiving parade or something. When have you met the Muppets? Like, so what was, give me the middle group again, the Meryl Streep group. Emma Thompson,
Neil Patrick Harris, Meryl Streep, Stephen Sondheim.
Okay. I mean, I'm assuming that most of these things were like Broadway related, like people were in the play and also in the audience of the play. How accurate is that?
I don't know. I've also seen Kevin Bacon, Gordon Ramsay, and David Boreanaz together, so I don't know what they're seeing.
That's true. It wasn't with me because you were with me and we saw Greg Kinnear.
We did see Greg Kinnear, and that was very creepy because that was a tiny, intimate show and he was just there.
That was weird. And I also saw Tom Hollander that day, and I can't remember. Kevin Bacon. I don't like him, so I don't. I have problems with the movie Hollow Man. And it's never. Fair. I've never been able to shake off like a weird fear of Kevin Bacon because of that. I feel like you'd seen David Boreanaz, I would know. And I feel like I don't even know that you've seen David Boreanaz in person. Yeah, and I feel same. Like if you have and you've been holding out on this after so long and Jealous Love, I would know. So I'm saying that one is fake.
Yeah, I'm strongly with that. You would tell us every day of your life if you met the Jealous.
Okay. The one that is fake is the Swedish Chef Kermit and Gonzo.
What a
Why?
Twist.
Because they're Muppets okay. and they're fake?
No, I have seen the Swedish Chef and Kermit together in one sighting, but Gonzo was not on display at the American History Museum.
Okay, all right. So,
I went to a performance of Sweeney Todd that Emma Thompson was in. Stephen Sondheim, Neil Patrick Harris, and Meryl Streep were all in the audience.
What?
They performed it. It was a staged reading at Lincoln Center. And okay. Christian Borle was also in it. You know, it was crazy. But that was the night that they were having the reception afterwards. I didn't know that when I bought the ticket, obviously. But at intermission, everyone was mingling like in the section below me. And I was just like in awe and couldn't breathe. And they like brought Stephen Sondheim up on stage at the end of it. And it was amazing. So that one is real.
Emma Thompson was in it.
And everybody else was in the audience.
Mrs.
Love it.
Yeah, love it. Yeah. I'm like the pie lady. Yeah.
Now, the other one was at the fan fronts for Glee.
What?
Oh, God. Okay.
What was he doing there?
Kevin Bacon was there promoting some crap. He also performed with the Bacon Brothers, which was amazing. Gordon Ramsay was obviously there in the press line for whatever chef show he had on the network at the time. Bones was still on TV.
Okay. This is before you were in love with Angel.
Well before.
I took tons of pictures
of David Boreanaz for my friend who was obsessed with Bones. And he was like playing the bongos and like joking around with like
what? He's weird. I like him a lot, but he's a very strange person.
So I
enjoy it, but I think he's like got a manic personality disorder or something.
So I saw the three of them together within one day because they were there and promoting random different unrelated things.
The Fox up front.
And then, I saw Emma Thompson, Neil Patrick Harris, Meryl Streep, and Sondheim at a performance of Sweeney Todd.
Was Neil in the play?
He was not. He was just there.
Who was?
He played Toby on the stage, or was it just for the Tony Awards?
He wasn't in this production. It wasn't.
Right, but in general, I'm saying I think he did at one point play Toby, right?
That I cannot confirm.
Who was Sweeney Todd?
I forget his name. He's like a bigger actor, more opera-y. Let me look it up. But Christian Borle was also in it. He was killed within like, you know, the first 10 minutes, but he was amazing. Why can't I remember this guy's name? Live from Lincoln Center. This was in 2014. It was amazing. I loved it so much.
Wow.
Audrey McDonald was also in it. Bryn Terfel. She was the beggar woman.
Okay.
I see it.
Cool.
Yeah.
This is all very exciting. Very insane.
This is like the best two truths in a lie we've ever had, Natalie.
I know. I looked at the doc early on and I was like, oh, I think I have an actual two truths and a lie that would kind of be fun. And I think I could get them with the Muppets.
Yeah.
Well, the Adianas for the last week were also great. I mean, it's like when Natalie and I do them at this point, like we've done all of the ones that we could together.
I just don't think that creatively. So I'm going to have to up the game.
Seriously. Okay. Yeah. You have to like stockpile these to get to the level that Adiana and Brittany do. Okay.
We have
one more segment before we haiku out of here. And that is the question of the day. Hashtag ask not another. I was going to say not another. Every time I see NATWP, I want to say not another Teen Wolf podcast. Ask not about the weather, anything you want to. And so we have a question from a friend and or listener, but this week it's from at Maria Gregg, who asks us, if you could interview one fictional character, who would it be and what would you ask them about?
Oh, my God.
I have one that immediately came to my mind. It was Hermione Granger, and I would ask him why she hung out with those stupid boys so long and why she continues to hang out with those stupid boys. It doesn't make sense. She's so much better than them. She deserves better than them. She deserves adult Draco, honestly.
I don't know about that.
It's my ship. It's my ship, okay?
I think Harry and Hermione are a perfectly reasonable friendship. And I understand Ron and Hermione as a couple in terms of, like, their friction. But I would like to know about if Hermione has friends that are...
not them.
On her level as well. Like, the additional friends that are on her level, you know?
Well, I would ask her about two... I would ask her about...
I bet her and McGonagall are, like, good adult friends.
Whatever age McGonagall may be now, yes. Yeah. I think I would ask her about two specific sequences with Harry to ask her, like, are those the moments that bonded you more with him as, like, a friend as opposed to, like, romantically with Ron? The first being in the books, of course, where she's doing the potions to get him through the fire for the last bit. And then the other would be just the whole tent sequence when Ron's gone and how they were like, I hate how in the movie,
it's not in the books. The tent sequence is not real.
Well, I'm not talking about in the movie sequence where they have them dancing and it's almost romantic. No, I'm talking about the general experience. A period
of time together. Yeah, that's true.
Cause they have like this very like, well, shit, Ron's gone. It's just the two of us. Yeah. Let's do it together. And they never really in the books had that romantic vibe, which I loved. And I think that if I had to ask her, I'd be like, so is that what led you to being with Ron? So that you had that different level, because with him, you didn't really have that survival thing. It's just, it's such a different vibe when she's with Harry. And if anything, then I feel like it'd be rude to ask somebody why you're friends with two of your best friends for your whole life. But pretending that I'm very brass in this fictional world where I'm talking to her, I would be very much so like, you need to find better people to be with.
Fair.
Well, out of the Harry Potter universe,
Does it have to be Harry Potter universe?
No. I'm saying getting out of the Harry Potter universe.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to think of what point in time I would like to ask this particular character my question, because so first of all, it's Renton from Trainspotting.
Oh, wow.
Would I ask him closer to Trainspotting 2 timeline or immediately at the end of Trainspotting what he... like where basically how he's feeling in the moment of having the money and getting out? Do I want to ask him it after he made all these other life decisions that makes him regret leaving? Or do I want to ask him in the height of euphoria of getting out?
Oh my God. That's intense.
Mm.
Ask you and McGregor on Twitter. He'll tell you.
Oh yeah. He'll probably tell me. That's right. You have a good track record of that. Maybe I will.
Yeah. That's really funny because you brought that up and I forgot. I'm like, I've actually kind of had
You've done that. And I didn't even think about it when I was.
Yeah, neither like, did I. Neither
my
did
mind
I.
went straight to like, amazing. Oh, I want to ask like Sick Boy something. And I'm like, no, Sick Boy's stuck in a loop. He's not going to answer anything. But like Renton's gone on a journey. I need to talk
to him. Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. That's a great one. There are so many. There are so many things and so many. I'd kind of like to interview Castiel from Supernatural because his life experience, like in the course of the show, like with the Winchesters, is like a blip, like of his entire life form. But it's had a very profound effect on him and it's like really changed like everything about him. And he's had this history of being that he discovered, which we've never really followed up on much more, that he's been like, apparently had like this kind of rebellious streak about like the way that, you know, the angelic host was meant to like defend the universe and or how they were meant to treat humans, and he's been like wiped before. So maybe it wouldn't be that useful to interview him because maybe he doesn't remember his whole life. But I just kind of want to talk about the, like, you know, the millennia, the mindset that he would have had for those millennia, everything he's seen and known, and like how it feels different now, like walking on Earth in like a human body, and why his emotional response is so different now, like, because when the percentage of the time that it's happened has been so small. So that's one thing. But I was also just looking at my DVD case and I'm like, let's sit down at dinner with Will Graham and Hannibal Lecter in
God, I could never even go there. I can't.
And like, yeah, in their, you know, in their marital home, running away together in South America, you know, waiting at the dinner table with, I would not be eating, but there are a lot of,
I would politely decline.
Yeah, that's probably for the best.
There's a lot of questions to ask there. I mean, there's so many people, isn't there? But, yeah, I think that Cass is a big one for me in terms of getting into his head. And, you know, and I do often interview Misha, but it's not quite the same. And, yeah, it's really I think that, yeah, Brittany, your answer is amazing and so is Mitch's, but there's probably a million more. So I'm actually want to throw this out to, like, literally anyone who hears this podcast, please tweet us at NATW podcast and tell us your answer for this, because I am just – I love this idea and I just would like to explore it even further.
Oh, my God. I would love to do, like, a special episode of just, like, here's – the three or four people of like a collective of fictional characters. So like from the same universe, like you did Will Graham and Hannibal, like if you could get the group together to talk to them. Like I would love to talk to the History Boys at any point in their life. Like
I was going to say Scripps. Scripps was going through my head and I'm like, I would really like to talk to the Howling Commandos that served with Steve and Bucky, like about that montage of 3 years that was like on the road, you know, when they were operating as a unit, as a secret sabotage unit in World War II, we get like a movie montage that covers like a couple of years of them on the road together. That's one of my favorite things that I would love to delve into. So yeah. But yeah, Scripps was nearly up there for me. So that's an interesting one too. What a great question. I really want to know everyone's answers to this. So
yes, tell us, because I do too. I think it's so fun to think about. And it sparks like so many different other things that you would not even think of, that you're like, oh my God, why didn't I think of that particular character first or that story? Or, you know, there's so many.
I thought you might say Phil Connors.
Really? That would actually be very interesting.
Yeah.
But he would probably still be a dick. So, I mean, I would want to know like what happened on like day 482 of being Phil, like, you know, like what did you do then? Wow. Yeah. Great. I would love to get like every character Andy Carl has played together in a room. So like Sergeant from like SVU and also, you know, Phil Connors and Rocky Balboa all together. The package guy from Legally Blonde, you know, just get them all together. Feel the room out.
Are you offended that you didn't make it into the Thank You Next video?
Yeah, seriously. Well, the package guy is there, but he doesn't get to
play. Not the Broadway. Not the
same actor, no, yeah.
Yeah, not the Broadway version. That's great.
Yeah. So that covers our question. Again, if you want to give us your answers to it, please reach out to us on Twitter, write it in a review, comment on our Instagram, get us on Facebook, Gmail, the website, ask us on Tumblr, whatever you want to do to get in contact with us. We'll check it all. And we'd love to see what kind of ideas they spark.
I'll say that Twitter is the most prominent.
Yeah. Facebook, you know what?
I don't really know how to run a Facebook page. So like maybe I should, but you know,
Whenever we say get in contact with us, please go on Twitter and tweet at us.
Or email. But the others are, I would like to kind of casually use the Instagram more to just catalog some hypes and gripes. But yeah, it's Twitter's obviously the most sufficient and accessible way for most people. So yeah, we get most of our questions from Twitter. So it's all good.
Yes. And then we like to end our episode.
Yeah,
with a high conclusion.
High conclusion.
Can we like abbreviate that in the doc, like where the stresses are on that? Beautiful. All right.
Watching this live is just a thing.
Yep. Now forevermore.
I don't know why I put conclusion with a K. Like it still makes
We do that sometimes too. Like Kristen's contemplations with the K.
Yeah, I suppose it is very Kristen's contemplations.
Anyway, so we write a haiku throughout the episode on things we talked about, and then we read it at the end and then we sign off. So I wrote one. It's not great, but, you know, here we go. Let shows be. Can you believe? Hallmark always.
Can you believe? Took me just a second to get, and then I was like, shook.
Can you believe? I couldn't get it with his inflection.
No, it's...
I will never be able to
It should be red that. Vanilla, so that then we have to read into it. I think that's the best part about it.
So anyway, that's a wrap on this episode. Come back for more. Listen to our old episodes. Just interact with us. That's all we ask.
There's plenty of fun to be had.
Make us feel like we have more friends. Anyway, we'll be back before the end of the year with another episode. So,
bye.
I won't say Merry Christmas, but I will say bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. Bye.